You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A sledgehammer and a tiptoe yesterday from a federal judge who slammed the National Security Agency's domestic surveillance programs for being unconstitutional, but he refused to issue an injunction to stop those same programs. Message from the judge. Let's see if we can figure it out here. Constitution, really big deal, but not so big that we should actually call the police to stop someone who's violating it. All right. The NSA is kind of like the police. Well, it is this tangled web of issues that we are plowing headlong into this hour. How is the government to be held accountable? Chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Dianne Feinstein, is supposed to be holding the government accountable, but she let these programs go on her watch. And now even she is wondering who to trust in the wake of this judge's decision on the NSA.
On one hand, you know, I believe it's healthy. I really do, to have this court oversight. That's what this government is all about, and I respect it. But on another hand, it's surprising because we thought we were depending on United States Supreme Court law set in 1979 and carried out by 15 individual district court judges as members of the FISA court.
Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California with some trust issues in the wake of a judge's decision in Washington. You got any trust issues out there, folks?
This is Sharon from Wareham, Massachusetts. I don't think any institution can be fully trusted anymore. I think everything that we go into nowadays needs to be gone in with a grain of salt.
My name is Robert McCollum from Salt Lake City, Utah. The question might be who you can trust. If that's the case, I'm a paranoid case study because I don't think we can trust Congress, the NSA, the president. I generally trust third parties, and I love my public radio. So long answer to say, I trust you. Please don't let me down.
Well, thanks for that. NPR, NSA, APM, PRI, a lot of acronyms. This hour, a trust theme from you and the people we talk with. Some conversations about government accountability. Are reporters good at that? Are they better than judges? Let's get reaction to the federal judge decision on the National Security Agency from Congressman Tom McClintock, Republican representative from California's 4th District, joins us today from California. Welcome to The Takeaway, Congressman.
Well, thank you for having me.
So what do you make of the judge's decision? No injunction, but it's an unconstitutional program at the NSA.
Well, it's a huge step in the right direction, this judge's decision. Obviously, it's going to be decided at a higher level. But it is a plain reading of the plain wording of the Fourth Amendment that the government has no right to seize or search your records without first demonstrating probable cause that you have actually committed a crime. And that is there for some very important reasons that go back to the American founding.
So are you on the same page with your colleague on the other side of the aisle, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, Democrat, that James Madison would be aghast by all of this?
I believe that James Madison would be aghast by all of this. And yes, I am on the same side. It's the side of the Constitution.
All right. Let's talk about the Obama administration. There was some talk of a possible amnesty decision or an amnesty offer to Edward Snowden, who, of course, is in exile right now, who apparently has a lot more documents and classified information that he has not given to journalists like Glenn Greenwald, who we're going to speak with shortly. In return for amnesty, he might give up those documents. Do you support a deal like that?
Absolutely. In fact, I called for it 6 months ago, and for two reasons. First, because as a practical matter, I'd rather have Snowden in America talking to Americans than in Russia talking to Russians. But more importantly, Congress was lied to over the very existence of the NSA program that seized the records of millions of Americans without warrant and in direct violation of the Fourth Amendment. We have some very good laws against divulging classified information, but there is a higher law. It's called the Constitution, and every government official, including Snowden, has taken an oath to protect it. By the way, I think it's very revealing that the oath of office is not to protect the country. It is to protect the Constitution.
Interesting point.
The reason is that if we lose the Constitution, we will have lost the country. So as a practical matter, if the government can violate the Bill of Rights and can also order that that violation has to remain secret, then by definition, those rights become unenforceable, and those who violate them become unaccountable. So, yes, I support amnesty for Snowden, always have.
Any sympathy for the Obama administration not wanting to establish precedent and have leakers come out of the woodwork? And finally, could you call a federal marshal to actually go get the people who have lied to Congress on all this?
Congress was lied to by James Clapper. And yes, I believe that Congress should prosecute him, and I'm very disappointed that it doesn't. You know, if it tolerates that kind of conduct, it's going to encourage
All
more
right.
of it.
Congressman Tom McClintock, Republican representative from California's 4th District. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So trust and government accountability. This is a debate that's been going on since the Edward Snowden NSA leaks came to light earlier this year. And here's a part of the debate. If you feel better that the federal government is using its power to spy on American citizens and killing them sometimes, even as it did Anwar al-Awlaki in the War on Terror, it's a question of trust. The government will make the right decision, right? Here's journalist and Edward Snowden collaborator Glenn Greenwald posing that very question to journalist and columnist blogger Andrew Sullivan on The Bill Maher Show.
If for whatever reason you trust Barack Obama, the benevolent constitutional scholar, to pick and choose Americans in secret who should be killed, do you trust that that power, when it's vested in Newt Gingrich or Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin, you trust the president to be able to exercise that power? No transparency, no due process. I mean, if you trust the president to do that, what don't you trust the president to do?
That is the question. Can you trust the government? If you can, then the Constitution can be ignored. If not, then there needs to be mechanisms in place to assure government accountability. In part two of our interview with Glenn Greenwald, he acknowledges in a very wild year that he has managed to pose all of these questions and to be at the center of them as well.
You know, I mean, obviously it's been a very intense year. And I think ultimately, though, the way I would most characterize it is that I'm doing exactly that which I hoped to do when I went into journalism and started doing political writing. And essentially, I think that I found myself in the middle of the most significant story of politics and journalism, certainly one of them in many years, if not the last decade. And by and large, it's been very invigorating and gratifying to be able to do it, honestly.
So whether it was your intention or not, your career really delivered the message to Edward Snowden, at least, and probably many others, that you were perhaps the best address as a journalist to send information to, that one could be very, very confident, would be held in safekeeping, not ratting out to the government or ratted out to some editors within the journalistic entity that you worked for, that you would be a facilitator for someone who really wanted to use the information and access to government information to confront the government. How did you do that as a journalist? And do you think that is an appropriate role for a journalist, to be the kind of return address for people who want to commit acts as aggressive as Edward Snowden's?
Definitely. I think it's pure journalism to basically have sources know that they can come to you with complete trust that you're going to protect the information that they give you, responsibly report on it, but not be deterred or intimidated out of reporting on it, so that they didn't sacrifice or take the risk that they took for nothing. I think that one of the things that I've focused on in the 8 years that I've been writing about politics has been to focus on what the proper role of journalism is vis-a-vis political and corporate power, and that role ought to be adversarial, designed to provide a meaningful check on what people in power do and not to accommodate them or serve them or become their spokespeople. And so I think through that message that I've developed over the years, the criticism that I voiced about other media organizations that suppressed information that was newsworthy at the behest of the government, or which got too close to the factions over which they were supposed to be exercising journalistic oversight, that message has been conveyed. And I'm really glad that Edward Snowden had somebody who he trusted to come forward and bring this information to. And I think the question about whether it's appropriate is answered by the impact that these stories have had in provoking real debate around the world.
If somebody inside the government in a position that you were convinced was authentic came to you with something that represented their view of what they believed the government shouldn't be doing, Is there any circumstance you can envision where you would say, no, I'm not going to publish that?
Oh, yeah, of course, of course. There's many tens of thousands of documents that I've had for 6 months, and a small number of those documents have been published because among the material are things I would never publish. For instance, I would never publish material that would provide specifications for how surveillance systems could be built by other states. I would not subject other human beings around the world to heightened surveillance by publishing the book on how to do that. I would not publish the names of agents in the field or other people's names whose lives could be in danger if their identities were exposed. I wouldn't publish the information that the NSA has gathered on particular people, their identities, their emails, their telephone calls, if I had those, because that would assault their privacy. There's a whole range of information I wouldn't publish and haven't published, even though I could.
I'm glad to hear you say that, but at one point you said to Andrew Sullivan, okay, so you trust Barack Obama's ability to determine who should be killed, who shouldn't be killed, who's a spy, who's not a spy, and without transparency, you trust his judgment whether to go in, for instance, in Yemen and kill al-Awlaki. But would you have the same confidence in a Sarah Palin with her finger on the button, or a Newt Gingrich with his finger on the button? Can that same charge be leveled at journalists? I mean, you're a great guy. You have a lot of responsibility, it seems like, but in an untransparent world of leakers making relationships with journalists, can we really trust that the standards that you have will be followed by others?
No, of course not. I mean, every single process is subject to abuse. I mean, obviously, in the run-up to the Iraq War, the New York Times, the most trusted journalistic institution in the world, put one incredibly false and inflammatory claim after the next on their front page regarding the threat that Saddam Hussein supposedly posed and helped bring about a war. Journalism can be abused in all sorts of ways. And I think the question always is the journalist in question acting responsibly or not? And like every profession, journalists have some responsible people and some irresponsible ones.
Should there be transparency? Should you be held accountable?
Sure. I mean, the way I'm held accountable is that I appear on shows like yours and I answer questions about what it is that I've done and I have to defend my own actions. The public will ultimately judge what it is that I do, just like anybody else who's acting in a way that affects the public, that affects public life. And I think that's how it should be. I think everybody who affects the public domain, including journalists, ought to be held accountable in all sorts of ways. And that certainly includes me.
I'm wondering if in 2014 you're looking forward to maybe a boring year.
I would love a boring year. And every time I think that my life has a chance to return to a little bit of normalcy, something happens. Like, I don't know, I decide I'm going to start a major news organization that sort of undermines that goal. But yes, one of my goals for 2014 is to have a little bit of quiet and normalcy restored.
Glenn Greenwald, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Glenn Greenwald is the journalist who worked with former NSA contractor Edward Snowden to report on classified NSA programs. He's since left The Guardian and is now starting his own media company with Pierre Omidyar, the founder of eBay. You can find a full transcript of our interview with Greenwald by visiting our website at thetakeaway.org. To the Middle East now. In the Syrian conflict, the response of the international community has been to mobilize to confront the use of chemical weapons, while the wider implications of the war have been left to various humanitarian agencies in an effort that has lacked coordination and certainly profile. For doctors, the prognosis for the millions of displaced Syrians is looking grimmer and grimmer. Severe winter weather has set in the region, and in the same week that the United Nations has tried to launch its biggest international aid campaign ever. Individual families who have been displaced by the Syrian civil war, the next few weeks could prove fatal. From his posting last week in Jordan, Syrian-American doctor Hamam Akbik from Ohio saw enormous medical needs, which he was compelled to face with pitiful resources.
There's a big problem in delivering the aid, who is getting the aid, how the aid is distributed. I don't want to call it mismanagement of the aid, but there's clearly a disconnect between the aid that currently has been provided and the way the aid has been delivered. In Jordan, over $1 billion has been spent collectively from the UN, from the Gulf countries, people in the camp, There's only 145,000 people inside the camp. They still live in tents. They still live in misery. They still don't have the human basic needs.
Give me a sense of the people who you've encountered in Jordan and just the specific stories of how you were able to help them, what their needs are, what they fear is going on back in their hometowns.
Imagine in this weather where you have in the camp, for example, the temperature is below zero. There's extreme mud and pocket of water around the tents. And the closest water source to you is about 500 to 700 meter. The closest restrooms is about 500 to 700 meter. How can a mom take her kids to the bathroom? How can a mom get some water for her kids to cook and to drink in this dreadful weather? And they do not have the proper clothing to combat this element to be able to go and get there. This is a very small picture that if anybody can close their eyes and imagine this, they'll be able to at least understand the catastrophe that those people are living in.
Is there a family that you're particularly worried about who you encountered when you were in Jordan that you're thinking about now in the middle of this weather?
There's two specific families that I met, and they touched the heart of all the medical team that was with me at that time. I was doing, my team was in a big tent. We had a medical day at the tent, and we were seeing patients, and I was asked to go and do home visits for people who cannot come to the big tent. So we drove around and we went to a tent to see a man who his arm, part of his left arm, is missing the bone. So basically, his arm is attached only by skin and muscles, whatever left muscles, because all the muscles are atrophied, to his body. That's all is left of his arm. And he has no access to medical help, but that's not the issue. The issue is his neighbor, a woman, brought her child to us, her 11-month-old child, asking me to check on him because he has a small dimple in his thigh. When I checked him, I immediately noticed that this is a rhabdomyosarcoma. It's a form of the most vicious cancers that can attack kids. We have a pediatrician with us. I carried the kid immediately in the car, took him back to the tent. I asked the pediatrician to see him. I said, "What do you think?" He said, "I think you are correct. It's rhabdomyosarcoma." I start making some phone calls, and then we've discovered that really, there's no way we can treat these kids. Now I'm faced with the situation that I have to tell the mom that your 11-month-old boy is going to die in front of you with cancer and nothing we can do about it. The other story that we have, 11-year-old who had a myoma or myosarcoma in his groin. We told the dad that we need to try to help him. We need to get him at least a biopsy. The dad said, "If you want to do the biopsy," and the answer came back, or the results came back as cancer, "What are we going to do with him?" I stumbled for a second. I didn't know what to answer. He said, "That's exactly why I'd rather him die in the tent." It's, as a physician, as a medical personnel, I have not been faced, especially here in the U.S., of anything like that. We have not been trained in medical school of how to deal with these things. When you have families, you're going to tell them. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. I don't know what those people are doing right now. It's very hard. It's just very hard.
And if there was no war, they would be treated.
Oh, absolutely. There's cancer centers in Syria itself, in Damascus, in all the other cities around Damascus. In each city, major city, there is a cancer center those kids can go to, their children's hospital. Even if they cannot deal with it, they usually send them to the capital, either to Aleppo, if they are closer to the north or to Damascus, or if they're closer to the south. They can go to Children's Hospital where they can get the surgical treatment, and then adjacent to the Children's Hospital, for example, in Damascus, right next to it, there is the cancer center where they can get the radiation and chemotherapy needed.
Well, Dr. Akbik, thank you so much for the numbers. And could we just have the name of that 11-year-old who has so affected you?
Well, I'm not sure if I can say his last name, but his first name was Omar.
All right. Well, the best for Omar, of course, and all of our thoughts and prayers to you and the people that you're attempting to help. Dr. Akbik, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting me. I appreciate it.
Dr. Hammam Akbik is a Syrian-American doctor. He returned from Amman, Jordan last week, where he was helping refugees. And now, a fire sale in the Motor City. You find yourself in debt, no income coming in. Maybe it's time to unload those electric guitars. How many do you have? The fast cars, how many you got? And the priceless painting on the mantelpiece. Well, the city of Detroit finds itself precisely in this situation to the tune of $18 billion. The Detroit Institute of Arts, you might say, is the mantelpiece of the city. In its art collection, Diego Rivera's Detroit Industry fresco cycle and a Vincent van Gogh self-portrait, Christie's Auction House has been given the job of determining the collection's cash value as the city is in bankruptcy. Some might say Christie's has been given the thrilling opportunity to drool over one of the top 10 municipal art collections in the U.S. Dr. A. Paul Skop, can you do anything about this?
Well, John, we're trying. There is a fund that has been started by Dr. Gerald Rosen. He's the mediator of the bankruptcy. And the purpose of that fund, which hopefully will be $500 million, is to protect the DIA treasures as well as help the Detroit pensioners.
Now, how would you describe yourself? Are you an art collector, a philanthropist, part of the movers and shakers class there in Detroit?
Oh, I'm not a mover and shaker. I'm a former organic professor at Wayne State University and also a founder of a biotech company, Lumigen Incorporated. Now retired from both, and I would say philanthropist. I still do a lot of things at the university.
And what have you pledged to try to help get this fund off the ground?
My wife and I have pledged $5 million.
Now, would you ordinarily use that money to actually buy art, or is this perhaps the best way of actually preserving art that's close to you, maybe even better value than buying something on the open market?
Oh, $5 million would not buy the kind of art that is at the Detroit Institute of Arts. No, I'm working along with others to protect the treasures of the DIA.
What is the sense of the value of these treasures to the people of Detroit? I mean, is there a trade-off here where the people of Detroit maybe need to get out from under this bankruptcy more than they need to see a Diego Rivera or a Vincent van Gogh?
That isn't a choice that should have to be made. We need to protect the pensions, but we also need to protect the treasures at the DIA for generations to come. No, that's not a trade that should be made.
What is it like in conversations in Detroit? Do people have a sense of, oh, the art people are going to do what they want, but we're much more concerned about our pensions? Has the bankruptcy really divided constituencies in the city over what to do next?
I think it has that potential, but what Judge Rosen has proposed, and he calls this the grand bargain, is in fact to prevent such tensions and divisions so that both the treasures of the DIA can be protected as well as the pensioners.
I mean, the numbers, you know, are saddening. I mean, you know, Michael Bloomberg, our mayor, probably has that amount of money in his, you know, his Christmas club account, right?
Well,
$500 million isn't that hard to come up with.
We'd take a check from them. People all around the country as well as overseas are sending money to a fund at the Community Foundation for Southeast Michigan.
All right. Well, good luck to you. We'll definitely follow this and check in on your progress. $5 million down, $500 million to go. Dr. Paul A. Paul Skop is a philanthropist in the Detroit area who has pledged $5 million to help offset expected losses by city pensioners, and hold on to the art collection at the Detroit Institute of Arts. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, John.
Tonight just might see the biggest lottery payout in U.S. history. Mega Millions could hit a cool billion. And if you and your 259 million closest pals all play a single number in the 43-state game and the District of Columbia and the U.S. Virgin Islands, you are absolutely assured of winning. Those are the odds, 259 million to one. And you wouldn't make much money if you think about it. 259 million people times a buck, that's 259 million. If it hits a billion, you'd share 640 million with all those people after taxes. You know, there's got to be an easier way to make some serious money. How about betting on the S&P 500 stocks this year? David Yanofsky, writer for Quartz, welcome.
Hello.
So the S&P has been as close to a sure thing as you can get by some measures.
It's been up 20 so percent this year. It's been one of the best years in recent memory.
And 20%, that's fine. But you really got deep into the S&P numbers, and you claim that if somebody had played the S&P in a certain way over the last less than a year, they'd be doing a lot better than Mega Millions.
You could have made over $200 billion this year, $264 billion, had you known which member of the S&P was performing best on any one day.
Now, is this a game or is this a legitimate sort of metric of how well the S&P is doing? Explain how I'm a 65-year-old pensioner, how I might have gone about doing this.
Well, imagine you knew what tomorrow was going to bring. If you knew that tomorrow that shares of Netflix would go up by 15%, you could buy some Netflix right before the close and then take in 15% the next day, and you'd know what's happening after that. And so you'd sell your Netflix and you'd buy Best Buy.
And there were lots of stories like that in the S&P, that if you played the big performers each day, that's where the big money comes in.
There was a lot of big performers. Some companies had daily increases of 40%, 60%. The top performer typically did around 6 or 7%. But if you could do that day after day, you would get effectively a 2% compounded return every day. You'd be making 2% every day, and that would turn a $1,000 investment into a $264 billion nest egg.
Nest egg, yeah. Yeah, would love to. You could put one or two kids through college on
just
that. Maybe yeah,
one or
who
two.
Knows? But David Yanofsky, is this a harmonic convergence of the planets where this is not likely to recur in the S&P? Or can you play similar kinds of math games on almost any year where you look at the stock market?
Pretty much any year.
About half of the people in the United States understand that the stock market is doing really, really well. What do you think is going on here?
I mean, there is confidence in the economy. There's fatigue from a less than thriving economy, and people are used to seeing over the last couple of years markets not performing like this, and they're having flashbacks to to the good times.
With a 20% return, though, even if you didn't focus as heavily on the fabulous performers each day, you could do even better than 20%, right?
Yeah, I mean, just investing in the S&P straight out would get you 21.4% this year,
which is huge.
One analysis that we did, which is actually slightly worse, was what if you knew what was happening yesterday, and if you invested in the top performer of yesterday, you'd end up with a 19% gain. Now that's of course ignoring trading fees, which would have eaten away all of your money, taxes.
Exactly. Yeah,
you're getting taxed.
That's one of the problems here. Let's just say, as a pure sort of math exercise, what are the odds that you could have, with your $1,000, actually stumbled upon this $264 billion result?
Well, assuming that picking the best performer of the day is a 50-50 chance, which it's nowhere near to.
Right.
It's at worst, it's 1 in 500. Maybe it's 1 in 100. But the odds of if it was 50-50... you had a 50-50 chance for 241 days, you'd have a 1 in 3.5 trevigantillion chance. Imagining these results.
That's depressing.
And so, that is 72 zeros.
Right. So Mega Millions looks like a much
Mega
better
Millions
idea.
Is a much better bet.
Much better bet. If you're looking for a billion. If you're just looking for a 20% return, S&P just fine.
S&P's great.
Are you going to play the Mega Millions?
I will buy the Mega Millions.
David Yanofsky, reporter for Quartz. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
So as we've heard, you can invest in the lottery. You can invest in the stock market. You can invest in yourself. Isn't that what you're told? Invest in yourself. If the odds of making a billion in the lottery are low and making a few hundred billion betting on the S&P are even lower, as we learn from David Yanofsky, betting on yourself may actually be one of the worst investments of all right now. The latest data from the Labor Department show that 6 out of 10 of the fastest growing categories in the U.S. are low-end service jobs, hospitality, tourism, lesser paid areas, and home health care. Part of what this means is that while the job market is improving, the chance of investing in yourself and being able to expect steady incremental gains over the course of your employment life, that's looking pretty dubious in this economy. Rana Faruhar joins me now in the studio, assistant managing editor of Time Magazine. Is investing in yourself kind of a bad idea in this economy right now?
Well, if you don't have an advanced degree, if you're not at the higher end of the labor market, yes. We have a real hollowed out middle. And just to give you a sense of how bad this problem is, I want to give you two figures. So since the financial crisis of 2008 and the recession that followed, 2/3 of the jobs that were lost over that period of time were high-end jobs, well-paying jobs, professional jobs. But half of the jobs that have been created since then are these low-end service jobs that you were talking about. So the middle has truly gotten hollowed out. There are $15 an hour jobs, and there are jobs for PhDs, but there's not enough in the middle.
And if you're at the $15 an hour job level, there isn't necessarily an obvious path into management or to running the company at the McDonald's or Burger King.
That's right. And I think that that's why you're seeing strikes where a lot of service workers in these fast food chains are walking off their job. Walmart has been having problems with these issues. You know, there are certain companies that are starting to actually think about giving back some profits to workers because people cannot make it, particularly in a city like New York or any other major metropolis, even if they're working full time on $15 an hour.
And, you know, we noted that the price of a lottery ticket is a buck, right, and possible billion-dollar return. The price of a PhD ticket to get one of the big jobs at the high end, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the return on that investment could take quite a while.
That's absolutely right. And there's a growing debate right now about, is education worth it? Is a four-year degree worth it? Now, I will say a PhD is almost always worth it. If you look at the statistics in terms of who's actually able to monetize their education, people with advanced degrees can generally do that. But if you look at four-year degrees, it really depends on what field you're going into. So you will notice a big difference in the average graduate wages of, say, a liberal arts major, an English major, a history major versus a software developer, someone with a science and technology degree. It's going to be a huge divide.
And if we're trying to think in terms of, you know, what is our general chance in the economy if we have a general set of interests, is that a really bad way of approaching the economy right now? Unless you have a specific idea of a specific category of work that is growing right now, you can't expect necessarily to come into an institution and be able to rise within that institution.
You can't. It's true. I mean, there are certain trade skills, interestingly, the kinds of things that we used to learn in shop classes in the 1970s that are actually quite lucrative. Welders can come out of school or prison as it is. Actually, welding is becoming a big training area in prison because you can come out and make $80,000 a year. Four-year English major at a sort of a B or a C level college, not so much. Depends on what kind of education you get, where you get it. I think in some ways this is going to make the top tier schools even more competitive because having that name and a pedigree is going to help you in the labor market. But also being a creative thinker, being able to be entrepreneurial, move quickly from one field or problem to another, all these things are going to become very important.
Are the numbers there, though, for the people who might want those kinds of jobs? I mean, say everyone decided tomorrow, okay, fine, I'm going to forget whatever it is I'm doing and go into the creative realm. Yeah. Are there enough jobs there?
Right now, no. And one of the biggest questions in the labor market right now is when are we going to have the next tech-related boom. So every couple of decades, there's a major shift in technology. So the last one was probably in the 1990s with the software industry developing. Post-World War II, there was a lot of mechanization in factories. Each time there's a big tech shift in our economy, there's a 2 to 5 year period of lag, and then you see a lot of job creation. The problem is we have not seen that yet. So we've had the dot-com boom, but we don't have those jobs that should have been created off the back of that in the middle. Again, we have a lot of PhD jobs and a lot of jobs being done assembling computers in China. Some of those are being done by robots now, but you don't have those jobs in the middle.
And one of the ironies is because of this lag time that you're talking about, even though there's some good news in the manufacturing sector, even outside of the automation that you talked about, it's more likely that someone coming out of prison with a welding skill is going to be able to take advantage of that than somebody who's going to have to shift gears out of the sort of creative realm into manufacturing.
That's absolutely right. And again, I think that that's why you're seeing a lot of people really think, is it worth it to take on a lot of debt to get a four-year college degree? That's a debate that's going to continue to unfold. There's a lot going on in online education right now. I think a lot of people in the future, younger people who are coming out and seeing this job market and facing the highest youth unemployment rates in years, those are still in the double digits, they're going to say, well, you know what, maybe I'll take a 2-year associate's degree and then I'll do some online courses to finish up my 4-year degree.
What would you recommend based on the numbers in terms of if you're a young person and want to invest in yourself, or if you're someone mid-career and really need to invest in yourself? What's the highest probability of success?
You know, it's a great question. And I hate to say this, but it depends on what kind of socioeconomic group you're coming from.
Really?
If you are someone...
A rigged game.
It is a rigged game. It is a rigged game. You know, I think that if you're someone that can go to a great four-year school, if you can go to Harvard and not take on a lot of debt, yeah, do it. That will still pay off for you. But if you're someone who is going to need to take on $100,000 worth of debt to go to a mid-tier college somewhere without name recognition, then I think you may be better off with an associate's degree and focusing on some sort of a real marketable skill that you know you're going to be able to monetize.
Higher probability, winning at Mega Millions or taking a mid-career job at Walmart and expecting to rise into management at Walmart?
Oh, man, that is a great question. I'm not sure I want to go on the record with this. I may still say rising at Walmart, but the difference could be marginal.
All right. Well, thanks for going there.
Thank you.
Rana Furuhar is Assistant Managing Editor of Time Magazine. Back to the issue of trust. Now that the NSA surveillance programs have been called unconstitutional by a federal judge, who trusts their government out there? From Salt Lake City, Utah, one of you says trust is something earned. The government lost my trust long ago. 2013 only made my mistrust concrete. And some humor from Grants Pass, Oregon. I trust my cat more than the government, and I don't trust him at all. Sarah from Dallas, Texas. It's hard enough to put complete faith and trust in people you personally know. How in the world can you trust that the left and right will get anything done? 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Much more at thetakeaway.org. Who are you indeed? The famous CSI theme. TV crime solving, one hair and bone fragment and molecule at a time. The pop culture magic of all these forensic detective TV shows. Go back to this guy.
But how do you know about them?
Elementary, my dear Watson. This man has been dead for at least 2 hours.
Sherlock Holmes, the original crime scene investigator, right? Whose sciency whodunit approach to crime was a revelation back in the late 1800s, in the days of Jack the Ripper and Queen Victoria. But he was just as much a part of pop culture as CSI is today. And yet, here's a real crime scene investigator who dreams of Sherlock every day.
Having his deductive powers really can help give you an idea of not only where to start, but where to go. He would get right over a piece of evidence and study it with his magnifying glass, which is still one of my favorite tools today. It's my magnifying glass. I go nowhere without it. Nowhere.
That's Karen Smith, a crime scene investigator featured in a new documentary about Sherlock Holmes. Kind of makes you wonder what kind of hat she wears or if she smokes a pipe. Kimberly Sue Moran has neither strange British hat nor a pipe, but she is a forensic archaeologist featured in this new PBS documentary, How Sherlock Changed the World. It airs tonight. For Moran, Mr. Holmes is still the standard, and the rest of us are all Watsons.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the most powerful things about Sherlock is we talk about him as if he were a real person. Clearly, he's a character from fiction, but we don't talk about his author. We talk about him, and that just is a testimony to how impactful he's been in our field of forensic science and criminal investigation.
Do you think that Arthur Conan Doyle sort of compiled a sense of science that was coming together at the time that these books were written, that embodied in the character of Sherlock Holmes is a set of converging sort of developments in science and investigation and in technology?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the late 1800s was really an exciting time to be alive in terms of forensic science. There were a lot of things that were happening. He was a student of Dr. Bell, who was a renowned pathologist. And so a lot of the medical insights that he's added to his stories were a direct result of his education under Dr. Bell. And then also there was a lot going on in terms of fingerprinting at this time. We have Galton, who's in the United Kingdom, who is looking into criminal profiling and trying to understand if you could look at a person and if you could measure certain features, if that would tell you if that person was predisposed to being a criminal. And in the course of that work, he started looking at fingerprints, and really fingerprinting just took off under him and under a few others that were operating at that time. And then also you have Edmond Leckard, who is in France, who created this exchange principle that we still use today about how whenever things come into contact, they leave a trace of that contact. And it was that theory that really caused all forensic science to come after it.
And pre-Sherlock, pre all of these people that you're talking about, pre a sort of scientific approach to criminal investigations, we really weren't that far from the, you know, dump people into water to see if they float and are a witch kind of era,
yes,
right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Basically, the only way that you could prove someone committed a crime was to either have an eyewitness or to get a confession out of that person. And yes, as you say, there were all different ways to find one or the other, to either find an eyewitness or to get a confession. So before we had this idea of physical evidence of traces and contact between victim and suspect, between suspect and environment, we really didn't have a lot to help us in solving cases.
You know, Sherlock Holmes in all of the books is absolutely convinced that there's a trail that can be found from point A to point B. Do you share that sense of confidence? I mean, you sound very enthusiastic, but could you match the confidence of Sherlock?
Well, yes. I mean, again, it goes back to this idea of exchange. Every contact leaves a trace. And not just the crime itself, but all of the events leading up to a crime being committed, whether it's having a motive or securing a weapon or having an accomplice or whatever it may be, there's going to be evidence of traces of contact. The tough part is for the investigators to actually find those traces. There will always be evidence. There will always be evidence, but someone's got to find it and then preserve it in a way that it's actually useful. It can actually be taken to court.
You know, as you describe, Conan Doyle really is writing about the emergence of science as a way of solving problems in criminal investigations. There are elements of science that are brought to bear here, though, that are very, very disturbing. I mean, while forensics was certainly a very exciting form of scientific inquiry regarding criminal investigations, some of the psychological elements actually tended to categorize people in ways that were almost frightening.
Well, yes. I mean, Galton that I was speaking of earlier, essentially he was practicing eugenics. He was trying to link a psychological trait with a physical type. And that is kind of scary. And you know, that still happens to a certain extent. There have been some interesting studies with fingerprinting where they've looked at the pattern of fingerprints and they've decided that certain pattern types match up with certain ethnic groups. So if you're Caucasian, you tend to have arches. If you're African, you tend to have whorls. And then there are other studies that link IQ with fingerprints. So the more complex your fingerprint is, the lower your IQ. So if you marry up those two studies of whorls, which are quite complex, being linked to a certain people group and then also a lower IQ, you can have some very disturbing conclusions at the end of that.
Well, as a forensic archaeologist, you're in more of a safe zone where it's all based on real evidence and that sort of thing. I'm wondering if there are any crime scene investigators or criminal profilers or television shows about Law and Order that don't owe a debt to Sherlock Holmes on some level?
I really can't think of any. Really, Sherlock was the beginning of all the enthusiasm. You know, we talk about the CSI effect a lot and the positives and the negatives of the CSI effect. But Sherlock really was the beginning of that, of getting people interested in using science, getting people interested in solving the crime, in investigating. And all of that has just spun out of Sherlock.
Do you think he would, be comfortable in the television shows of today as a crime scene investigator? What technique, what technology would particularly excite him?
Well, I think just seeing the new BBC version of Sherlock shows that he's very comfortable in the 21st century. It works out quite well. I mean, the thing that one could question is whether Sherlock would actually stand up in court today. So one of the things that Conan Doyle never shows in his stories is that evidence that Sherlock finds solving the crime, he never actually shows it getting to the courtroom and whether it actually holds up under scrutiny. And some of the techniques that Sherlock uses, and even some of the techniques that we use today, have a tough time when it actually has to come into a courtroom scenario.
And he would find some of Robert Downey Jr.'s sort of martial arts antics rather ludicrous, wouldn't you think?
Probably just a bit, yeah.
Entertaining, but ludicrous. But after all, the fellow was completely a figment of Arthur Conan Doyle's imagination, so we can make him what he will.
Yeah. And, you know, again, showing that he is still alive and well over 100 years later, that we're still being able to reinvent him and utilize elements of the story just shows what a powerful character he is.
Kimberly Sue Moran is a forensic archaeologist featured in How Sherlock Changed the World. It's a PBS film that premieres tonight. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
One more thought about trust where we began this hour. Does transparency help? Does seeing the inner workings of government help you to hold it accountable, help you to trust? Lisa?
I still trust institutions for the most part. I just think news agencies show too much of the legislative process to the point of everything looks bad. Congress now focuses on poll numbers because of this. Same with the White House.
Good point from Lisa in Florida. Thanks for that. You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.